tuning stubs on the outside and save yourself a little bit of metal work. Well, at least there's only one loop that you've got to deal with. As far as legalities go, if you want to follow the letter of the law precisely, you need a methodology of being able to send a transmitter off. So, although you'll find thousands of sites with it, you know, not the case, but we actually can do that. So it's interesting. KQRIWK2EJ.
I am guessing in some cases the remote control of that transmitter, the link transmitter from the receiving site back to the voting location, in some cases that control can be done by internet. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, I do it by a combination of internet and over the air, so. And as long as you've got your timers going, you're okay. I don't actually have a problem with doing it one of three methods, which we did at one point, but I don't anymore. One is a phone line, one is the internet, and one is over the air via phones. KQRIWK to EJ.
Now, let me have you repeat. You're saying the methods of sheet metal to synthesize the cavities. In other words, the cavity doesn't have to be round. Are you building it as a piece of strip line with sheet metal? Is that what you're advocating, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, there's this extruded aluminum that has channels, interlocking channels in it, and places for you to mount screws. So you need a bottom plate and a top plate, and if you do it in a rectangular structure. I've actually got six cavities for 6 meters. Yeah, they're tall. They're round. They're pass reject type filters, and they're big. They take up space. We made a set of cavities out of this interlocking stuff. A friend of mine and I. This is quite a number of years ago, and it worked out pretty good.
I'm going to add some words to this one, Bob. If you bought a piece of extruded aluminum U-channel, and maybe the U-channel is, let me pick a number, 2 or 3 inches wide, inch and a half high on the edges, U-channel extruded aluminum, 6 or 7 feet long, and then you put a top plate of aluminum across it, so it now becomes a rectangular cross-section piece of transmission line. And now you put a center conductor down it, which could be another sheet of metal as a strip line. That's not as wide as the U-channel, suspended with plastic spacers periodically. And so you're synthesizing a rectangular cross-section piece of coaxial cable out of U-channel. You could get lower performance, lower insertion loss than 7/8-inch Andrew Heliacs, and maybe approach the performance of inch and 5/8 Andrew Heliacs without having to buy the Andrew Heliacs. The extruded aluminum U channel might be a hell of a lot cheaper. So there's various ways you can homebrew this. But still, in my opinion, let me drop it.
Now, the hardest part was changing the length of the center conductor.
That's if you were once smart enough to calculate it ahead of time. Once you know the dimensions of your U-channel and the dimension of your sheet metal semiconductor, the characteristic impedance is well known, the velocity factor is well known, so you can calculate on the back of an envelope exactly how long it should be for your particular resonant frequency. Over to you on that one, Eric, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, the concept was there was a bunch of different repeaters that were being put together, and they needed to be on different frequencies. Yeah, it could have been done that way, but since we were, doing a set of them, we worked out a device that actually got a set of fingers on it and another piece of metal that sticks out more or sticks out less.
And you can tune this length electronically by putting a variable capacitor at the end, a piston capacitor, which could be a homebrew structure. But my own opinion, Bob, if you have never built or tuned a duplexing filter, go a little bit slow in that approach, because there's only 10 ways that you can do it wrong. To really build a high-performance duplex mixing filter is a big deal. I mean, all the instrumentation you can buy has roughly 100 dB of dynamic range in the ideal world. You need 130 dB of dynamic range to really tune this thing correctly. So, and to have very low insertion loss, and insertion loss that doesn't drift as a function of a hot day and a cold day and whatever. There's a lot of details required for a duplexing filter. I think you're ahead of the game with the split sight. Over to you, Bob, for any final comments. KA2GEF, K2LIW.
Okay. Well, I think the split sight might work out a little better. But if I were to get another two cavities, would I need two cavities or just one cavity to have both the transmitter and the receiver at the same site? Because if I can block the transmitter from getting into the receiver, all I need is one cavity. Am I correct or am I delusional on that? Back to you, Dick or Eric.
With one cavity, you can get as much rejection as about 50 dB. You need 120. Your minimum duplexer performance, in my opinion, takes four cavities for minimum performance. If you really want the repeater to come up to good sensitivity and not very much desensitization, you need four cavities. If you did it with six cavities, you'd have even better performance. But one cavity, not a chance. I think the bare minimum is four. Back to you, Bob.
Now, if the distance between transmit and receive is further apart, you can have a less cavity.
I accept that. So, if you do have a separate transmitter and a receiving antenna, and they're mounted 30 feet apart, vertically displaced on the tower, yes, maybe you can now do it with one or two cavities. But if you're really using a single antenna for transmit and receive, you need a minimum of four cavities. Back to you, Bob. Wait for the beeps.
Okay. All right. I'm going to try looking for cans again. But if not, I'll save myself a lot of money and go with the split sight. And I think that'll work out just as well. Because, yeah, 220, one more thing before I go. 220 is still available for linking, am I correct?
People have used all kinds of frequencies for linking. 220, 440, 1296, 900 megs, and so on. There's a zillion frequencies. I think your linking has got to be 220 and above, I believe, are the rules on that. Is that true, Eric? As long as you're above 220 megacycles, you can do linking. KE2EJ, K2IW.
That's correct, Dick. I don't know where he is with his QTH was talking about doing this, or even what the altitude is. But if we're talking about here, that's a tough call. If you're around here, 900, you can forget about it. Unless, you know, your next door to wherever it is you're looking from, because of all the ISM and all sorts of garbage and wireless phones and stuff like that. There's makes it hard. You know, I ran a 900 megahertz link between Glen Oaks and Selden. And to Selden, it was great. Glen Oaks then was like cell phone city, simply because it was in that building, which had all these 900 megahertz phones in it. But, and there's more efficient methods of doing linking these days. I mean, it depends upon, you know, you're talking about saving money, either buying the cavity or getting the radios for the link. You know, we're trying to start to do that kind of stuff with digital modems over the air to do the linking and have decent audio quality. So, you know, you can do just about anything. But, yeah, above 220 you can have links. But wherever you are, where it may dictate that you actually have to get it coordinated. So, there you go.
Yeah, unless your remote base is And your main base is in the boonies, avoid 900 megs because there's all kinds of stuff that can give you interference there. But there's a lot of frequencies you can use for linking. Okay, back to you for any final questions, Bob. KA2GEF, K2RIW.
Okay. All right, I appreciate it, and I'm going to see if there's any old going out of business paging company on low band that want to get rid of some of their cans. But it's been very informative, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Oh, yes, I'm on the South Shore in Baldwin. And the other receive site would be in Merrick. So there's only one town between us. And, yeah, I'm sure 900's going to be busy with all the cell phones. Not the cell phones so much, but the cordless phones. All right. I thank you very much, Eric. I thank you very much, Dick. KA2GES. We'll let you know.
Yeah, let us know how that works out, Bob. Craig is the next guy. I think it's Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Golf Bravo. Go right ahead, Craig. K2RIW. My name is Dick. Wait for the beeps.
By the way, I just want to stick this in. There's a bunch of 6-meter repeaters that are local in the area that are operating, so if you want to try things out, you can go to one of the existing repeaters.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Because these guys have been in operation for years and they've done it, visit some of the local 6-meter repeaters. Actually, touch the equipment, look at it. It'll give you some ideas. Craig, KD2OGB, K2LIW. Go right ahead, Craig.
KD2OGB Mobile. Was listening in on the whole thing, but wasn't into jumping in because I was trying to learn mainly what the topic was about.
Okay. The subjects that we talk about on the technical net are everything from DC to light. From time to time, we get into astronomy, cosmology, lots and lots of radio, and so on. So I think you're saying you don't have a specific question. Is that true, Craig?
Not really. I mean, when you just mentioned 6 meters, I just got my general, and I'm interested in learning 40, 80, and 10, mainly.
Yeah, there are very few repeaters on those frequencies, whereas 6 meters, 2 meters, a little bit of 220 and 450, you know, there's a whole lot of FM-operated repeaters.
There's a bunch of 10-meter repeaters.
How about that? So there are some 10-meter repeaters. And by way of the, what is it now called? Can't even think of the name of this book that ARL puts out. The Repeater Directory, ARL Repeater Directory. Get a hold of one of those and take a look at how many repeaters there are on each of those frequencies in each one of the states. Lots and lots of them. So there's 27 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is one of the 27 kinds. There are 26 others, if you know what I mean. AM, FM, sideband, television, digital, and so on. It just goes on and on. Media scatter, moon bounce, aurora, forward propagator, tropospheric scatter. It's just loads and loads of kinds of ham radio. So before, it's arguably this is one of the most educational hobbies there is. And if you're displeased with the particular kind of ham radio you're using, before you give up the hobby, try one of the other 26 kinds. Let me drop. We're now going to go over to the science and physics section run by Dr. Roy, AC2GS. And Dr. Roy, I know you haven't heard from me in 5 days. My internet, not necessarily internet, it's my email server company has failed for the last 5 days. And because we don't have a fixed address IP, Christopher cannot generate his own server. So we're waiting for them to either fix or he's going to find another server for us. So I have no ability to receive or transmit any emails for the last 5 days. I don't know how many more days it's going to be before I'm back on. That's the reason you haven't heard from me, Roy. AC2GS, choose any subject you like. We like all of them. You got it, Roy. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Tell you it's time to look into dynamic DNS. There's a number of companies out there that provide DNS services.
Roger. You got it, Roy.
Hello, Dick. This is AC2GS. I'm sorry to hear about the email. I couldn't go a week without email, so I would consider, you know, getting an emergency Gmail account. They're free, you know, as long as you don't put anything private on there, you don't really care if they read your stuff. I always think of email as stuff that I've written on a library bulletin board. I don't write anything down and send it through email that I wouldn't want someone's great aunt to read. So you might want to consider that. I just want to mention to everyone once again that if they want to send me a question or suggest a topic for discussion, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, that's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And almost everything I talk about is going to have links available if you go to a webpage called roy.ac2gs.com. And at the end of tonight's TechNet, I will post additional links for what I'm going to say. Let me drop. Every week I try something a little bit different. So this week what I'm going to try and do is I have a bunch of topics with a short little presentation of each. And then I will give a long pause between them. And if anyone wants to ask a question about it or make a comment about it, or wish some clarification, feel free to break in and give me a call sign. Okay, from the people that brought you Chernobyl, in the fine tradition of the Titanic, now bring you the world's first commercial floating nuclear power station, a 21,500 metric ton Russian vessel called the Akhmatik Lomonosov. Pardon the accent. It is presently making its way across the Arctic Ocean on its way to eastern Russia. What could possibly go wrong? Under Russian laws, this ship is not considered a nuclear installation until it's moored and made operational in Pevek. So Russia's nuclear regulators have not overseen construction, the testing, the fueling, or the transportation of the ship from its home port to its final destination. Of course, keep in mind that this nuclear regulatory body is the post-USSR version of the regulatory board that was involved with Chernobyl, so maybe this isn't such a bad thing. Nuclear reactors in seagoing vessels are nothing new. Many nuclear powers have built-in nuclear-powered war machines on the ocean, but this civilian nuclear reactor generates much more power, approximately 70 megawatts. Basically, what they've done is they've taken the reactor for large icebreakers and put two of them together and float them around. It doesn't go under its own power, it just floats, and you need a tugboat to move it. How will this all turn out? Well, check your papers for it, or wait for the inevitable James Cameron movie, although I think it will be a little bit more difficult to insert a romantic subplot on this ship. Next topic. Ask an investigator what is the least dependable kind of information, and they will very likely tell you an eyewitness's recollection. Memories just aren't worth the paper that they aren't written on. People often describe their very existence as the sum total of their experiences and their accurate memories of them. You are what you remember yourself to be, I guess. The trouble is that memories are not set in stone, but sort of like that toy most of us had as children, a plastic sheet over a wax black cardboard. Apply pressure and writing becomes visible. Pull it apart and the wax black cardboard and the writing almost disappears. And then you can either reproduce the previous writing or you can change it. This is called the plasticity of memory, and it is very plastic. Let me drop. Many researchers believe that every time we recall an event, we are doing something very similar to that old childhood toy. It's called the magic slate, by the way. Rewriting your memories. Sometimes we rewrite them accurately, other times not. They call that reconsolidation. We are wired to trust our recollections. After all, you wouldn't lie to you, would you? Well, yes, apparently you would. Do you remember that awful day when the World Trade Center was attacked? Do you remember watching the news, seeing all the videos played and replayed all day long? Do you remember watching that first plane hitting the North Tower of the World Trade Center that day? Well, I thought I did. The problem is that this video was not released until the next day. But don't feel so bad, because a researcher polled 569 college students back in 2003, and 73% of them remembered seeing that video the very first day as well. Unfortunately, memories, especially traumatic memories, can morph and reshape with each recall. Let me drop. And then there are false memories. Unfortunately, it is relatively difficult to introduce new memories into another person by just telling them about it, asking them if they can visualize it happening. After a while, it can just get assimilated into all the other memories and taken on as fact. This happened in the 1980s when well-meaning therapists inserted memories of early child abuse into a lot of people and led to a panic of daycare centers being dens of unspeakable evils, all the result of false memories mistakenly implanted into suitable minds. It was really a thing. It has its own wiki page. Trying to figure out how our memories work is an ongoing field of research that has earned a fellow at Columbia University a Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine back in 2000. That researcher likens our memories to notes scribbled on almost drying ink, easily smearable and prone to fading. Okay, let me drop. Okay, next subject. NASA, although I might be stepping on Paul's feet, I don't know. NASA launched something called SMAP, the Soil Moisture Active-Passive device, in 2015. It was the first NASA satellite specifically designed to measure global soil moisture, and it used two types of sensors. One is like a camera, the other is like a radar, and apparently they measure the microwave emissions from the land surface, which apparently correlates very closely with water content within the first 5 centimeters of the soil. SMAP is accurate to 4%, they say, and the images have a resolution of 25 square kilometers. This satellite can map our entire planet in as little as 2 to 3 days. Let me drop. The first round of SMAP data went public a few months ago, and it's supposed to be available on Google Earth. But the USDA just this week announced that it will be incorporating this SMAP data into the Crop Explorer tool. Crop Explorer tool is the USDA's massive tool that shows real-time information on global crops. It's used by agriculture analysts to predict everything from corn prices to whether there will be a flood halfway around the world. So that's it on that. Let me drop. We should aspire to being better, and that's quite true for CERN Large Hadron Collider as well. Plans have been completed for a major refit of a Large Hadron Collider, turning it into the High Luminosity Hadron Collider. This modification will increase the luminosity by a factor of over 10. They will be ready to begin the retrofit by 2023, and the Large Hadron Collider will be offline for the following 30 months and go back into service in 2026. This will enable the collider's experiments to boost the amount of data that they collect to improve the possibility of detecting new particles and bridge the gap between the Large Hadron Collider we have now and future even more powerful colliders. Okay, that's it. Let me drop. Researchers at Oregon State University have confirmed that last fall's union of two neutron stars did in fact cause a short gamma ray burst. The findings were published in the Physical Review Letters. Gamma ray bursts are narrow beams of electromagnetic waves of the shortest wavelength in the electromagnetic spectrum. Gamma ray bursts are the universe's most powerful electromagnetic events, which thankfully occur billions of light years away from us here, and are able to release as much energy in a few seconds as our sun does in its lifetime. Let me drop. Gamma ray bursts fall into two categories. A long-duration burst is associated with the death of a massive star with its remaining core reduced to a black hole. These last anywhere from seconds to minutes in duration. And then there are short-duration bursts, which have been suspected of being produced by the collision of neutron stars, which also produce a black hole. The short-duration burst lasts up to 2 seconds. During the neutron collision observed last summer, gamma rays were detected, but scientists weren't quite sure whether we were seeing an actual gamma ray burst or a burst of some gamma rays. You know, there is a difference. The gamma ray recordings weren't typical of previous short gamma ray bursts, but according to recently published findings, they believe this was due to the fact that we were viewing this gamma ray burst off-axis. If we were located on a planet axis with the burst, we would have recognized it almost immediately. Okay, that's that. Let me drop. Almost an endless number of metal alloys that demonstrate ferromagnetism at room temperature. But before, only three pure elements were believed to be ferromagnetic at room temperature, those being iron, cobalt, and nickel. Gadolinium just misses this list with a Curie point, which means the point that it loses its ferromagnetism, at 8 degrees Celsius below room temperature. But now the element called ruthenium was found to be ferromagnetic. A quick search in Wikipedia will reveal to you that ruthenium is listed as paramagnetic, not ferromagnetic, but the devil is in the details. Let me drop. The details are that ruthenium must be grown into an ultra-thin film in a tetragonal configuration. Usually, ruthenium prefers a hexagonal configuration. It took these researchers 2 years to figure out how to grow the required material and prove that it's ferromagnetic, but they did. The scientists involved in this discovery plan to investigate whether they can do the same thing with palladium and osmium. And find, you know, if they can, then there would be more ferromagnetic elements available to them. Is this going to revolutionize your kitchen magnets? No, it won't. But people at Intel and elsewhere are studying ferromagnetism out of unusual substances that might help in the design of future computer architectures when Moore's Law has hit. These findings may have an impact on the development of something called spintronics-based microcomputing. Time will tell. Okay, let me drop and I'll go to the next. Living can be dangerous to your health. In a study appearing in Environment, Science, and Technology, scientists report that the skin is a more important pathway for the uptake of cancer-causing compounds produced during barbecuing than inhalation itself. They also found that clothing cannot fully protect individuals from this exposure. In the U.S., 70% of adults own a grill or a smoker, and more than half of them grill at least 4 times a month, according to the Barbecue Industry Association. But barbecuing produces large amounts of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. These carcinogenic compounds that can cause respiratory disease and DNA mutations. Eating grilled food is the most common source of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons arising from barbecuing, but you can still get exposure if you just stand downwind from the barbecue. So, life is dangerous, what can I say? Okay, that's it for this, and I'll let it drop. AC2GS, by the way. A long while ago, we were discussing people with edematous extremities and the need for compression bandages. These bandages should not be too tight, they should not be too loose, but how are most people to tell the difference? Well, those smart engineers at MIT have developed the pressure-sensing photonic fibers that have woven into typical compression bandages. As the bandages stretch, the fibers change color. Using a color chart, a caregiver can stretch a bandage until it matches the color for the desired pressure before, say, wrapping it around the patient's leg. These photonic fibers can then serve as a continuous pressure sensor. If the color changes, the caregivers of the patient can use the color chart to determine whether and to what degree the bandage needs loosening or tightening. Let me drop. The color of the photonic fibers arises not from any intrinsic pigmentation, but from their carefully designed structural configuration. Each fiber is about 10 times the diameter of a human hair. The researchers fabricated the fiber from ultra-thin layers of transparent rubber material, which they then rolled up to create a jerry roll type structure. Each layer within the roll is only a few hundred nanometers thick. In this rolled-up configuration, light reflects off each interface between individual layers. With enough layers of consistent thickness, these reflections interact to strengthen some colors in the visible spectrum, for instance, and while diminishing the brightness of other colors. This makes the fiber appear a certain color depending upon the thickness of the layers within the fiber. Let me drop. The fiber's design relies upon an optical phenomenon known as interference, in which light reflected from a periodic stack of thin, transparent layers can produce vibrant colors that depend on the stack's geometric parameters and the material's composition. Optical interference causes colorful swirls and oil puddles and soap bubbles. It's also what gives peacocks and butterflies their dazzling, shifting shades, as their feathers and wings are made from similar periodic structures. The researchers are now looking for ways to scale up the fiber fabrication process. Currently, they are only able to make fibers that are several inches long. Ideally, they would like to produce yards or even kilometers of such fibers at a time. That's it for this topic. Let me drop. Corneas can be damaged by injury or disease. There are currently 15 million people waiting for a suitable cornea for transplantation. Scientists are working on 3D printing corneas specifically for each recipient. Researchers took corneal stromal cells from a healthy donor, mixed them with some alginate and collagen, creating a kind of bio-ink, which they then used to print out a 3D human cornea. It took them 10 minutes to print it. Of course, actual transplants can't be done with 3D printed corneas right now. They have to go through extensive testing. So there still will be a big shortage for a long time to come. So consider donating your corneas when you no longer need them. That's it for this topic. Let me drop.
A quick question on this one, Roy. When it comes to eye opacity problems, in other words, the cornea being fogged or the lens being fogged, I am guessing that by way of, it's not called glaucoma, it's called cataracts. By way of cataracts, the fogging of the lens happens more frequently than the fogging of the cornea. And therefore, lens replacement, I think, is maybe more popular than cornea replacement. That's a guess on my part. Over to you for any comment. AC2GS, K2LAW.
No, Dick, you're quite right. Cataracts are due to opacities in the lens proper. The cornea is an optical element in front of the lens. It usually doesn't become opacified, and when it's damaged either from injury or illness, it then scars up and causes blindness. The beauty of cataracts is that it has become a relatively safe and small surgery. When I first got into practice, you could tell a guy who's had a cataract surgery from a mile away. They had a slit in their iris that was obvious. Now you can't tell that people have had cataract surgery. And you can easily put in an artificial lens for the cataract replacement. You can't do that with corneas. Cornea replacement using just the same material wouldn't work. So you're quite right that thankfully the opacities of cataracts are much easier to fix because they involve the lens.
So I think you're telling me that right now the source of corneas for transplanting has to come from a donation of a what was once a living patient. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, until science learns how to build organs on big 3D machines, which they're working on every day, you have to go back to the source. And the source are other people who will their parts after they're gone and not going to use them anymore for people who need them so desperately. So, you know, the next time you take a look at that driver's license thing where they ask if you want to be a donor, give it a thought at least, because gosh knows we're not going to use it when we're gone, so you might as well get a little bit more action out of the organ. Okay, on to the next. For the first time, researchers at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory have created 5 grams of yellow cake, a powdered form of uranium used to produce fuel for nuclear power production, using acrylic fibers to extract it from seawater. They have chemically modified regular, inexpensive yarn to convert it into an absorbent, which is selective for uranium. It's efficient and it's reusable. The absorbent properties of the material are reversible, and the captured uranium is easily released to be processed into yellow cake. An analysis of the technology suggests that it could be competitive with the cost of uranium produced through land-based mining. Seawater contains about 3 parts per billion of uranium. It's estimated that there is at least 4 billion tons of uranium in seawater, which is about 500 times the amount of uranium known to exist in land-based ores, which must be mined. Okay, that's it for that topic. Let me drop.
I'm guessing with such a low percentage of molecules of uranium in the sea that filtering seawater to get uranium by that method is probably kind of slow and expensive. Is that true, Roy?
Well, I don't think it's expensive. It is kind of slow, but it scales up. So depending upon, and the material is relatively cheap. Probably the most expense is finding a means of getting all the salt water sea going through your filtration system. So that's where the major expense would be. But, you know, they've done some cost correlation studies, and they seem to feel that they can scale it up to the point where it would be significantly less expensive than mining the earth for the stuff.
Give me a break.
Oh, Roy, this is WA2VDH. Did they mention what the mechanism is of absorption of the uranium? Go ahead.
No, unfortunately, they kept it vague. I think they're doing this together with some major manufacturer, so they're probably going to be patenting the whole darn thing. But eventually, we'll get to use it in general. But they really, unfortunately, didn't give any good specifics about the materials. They kept pushing that it was cheap, and you could use recycled yarn even. You didn't even have to use fresh yarn for the base of the absorbent.
John, when you tried to sign in earlier, you gave us a VDH, and I went back to you. Did the particular link you were listening to fail because you didn't come back to us? Back to you, John.
Yes, let me apologize for that. I hit the up-down button on my microphone on my TR-751, and it jumped me over to another frequency before I realized it. And you went on to the next topic. I wanted to make a comment about the Sweet 16 speaker system. It has to be a square of the number of integers of speakers. You can't do it with 32. It's got to be 1, 4, 9, 16, etc. Go ahead.
To get the pure, usual, high-performance sound, you're absolutely right, it should be square. And the more you can make it round, it would even be better. And there's various ways you can stack 32 speakers in a round configuration, in my opinion. And if you did make it rectangular, it wouldn't stop working, just that it would be more directional. In other words, you'd have to be certain positions in front of the Sweet 16 or Sweet 32 in order to hear full fidelity. That's my guess. Back to you, John.
Okay, let me just apologize. I don't want to get off topic, but yeah, I think they made it. It's got to be a square integer because they series parallel the speakers. They did a 4 in parallel and 4 groups in series to keep the same impedance.
With difficulty, maybe with transformers, there's other ways of making sure the impedance is balanced. And the average hi-fi with all kinds of negative feedback these days, if it's intended to have an 8-ohm load, and you give it a 4-ohm load or a 16-ohm load, except for peak power output, you would never hear the difference. That hi-fi would still sound awfully good, in my opinion. Back to you, John.
Yeah, fine business. Yeah, I remember seeing one down on Cortlandt Street years ago. I think it was Edley Electronics. I know they were at the corner there on Cortlandt Street, and they had one of those speaker systems. Let me go back to the topic at hand. Thanks, Nick.
And when it comes to the radiometer-like satellite that you mentioned earlier, Roy, that's measuring soil moisture. A little bit later, I'm going to add some further comments on that one because it's a project, a similar but higher fidelity project like that. My company AIL worked on AC2GS. Please continue, K2RIW.
AC2GS, very good. Let's see. A in utero stem cell transplant for a critically ill second trimester fetus was instrumental in the birth of an apparently healthy infant. The newborn is the first patient enrolled in the world's first clinical trials of using stem cell transplantation prior to birth. The infant was born at the UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital, San Francisco, in February, 4 months after undergoing the transplant to treat a lethal form of thalassemia, a disease caused by a gene carried by nearly 5% of the world's population. The infant, whose parents were unknowingly carriers of the disease, was born at 37 weeks gestation, weighing just under 5 pounds. She has been discharged from the hospital and has returned with her family to their home in Hawaii. Let me drop. In utero stem cell transplantation involves extracting bone marrow from the pregnant woman between the 18th to the 25th week of pregnancy. The bone marrow cells are processed, and hematopoietic cells, immature stem cells that can evolve into all types of blood cells, are singled out from the mix. They are then injected through the woman's abdomen into the umbilical vein of the fetus, where they can circulate through the bloodstream, developing into healthy, mature blood cells. Unlike bone marrow transplants in childhood, the fetus's immune system is underdeveloped and has a higher tolerance of the mother's cells during pregnancy, which allows the transplant to take place without aggressive immunotherapy treatment. That's it for that topic. Let me drop. In February 2017, researchers announced that the dwarf planet Ceres had organic material on its surface. Now, a new analysis of NASA's Dawn data suggests that there might be a lot of that organic material than previously studies have suggested. As reported in geophysical research letters recently, the team changed the baseline parameters of their analysis to look for organic molecules. They study the sunlight bouncing off the dwarf planet's surface. Originally, they compared these signals back to rocks from Earth, but they decided in a new analysis, the researchers decided to use meteorites for comparison. They claim that it is a comparison standard. What they found was if they modeled the Ceres data using extraterrestrial organics, which may be a more appropriate analog for those found on Earth, then they needed a lot more organic matter on Ceres to explain the strength of the spectral absorption that they saw there. Let me drop. They estimate that as much as 40 to 50% of the spectral signals that they saw on Ceres is explained by organics. That's a huge difference compared to the 6 to 10% previously reported based on terrestrial organic compounds. So once again, science finds a lot of organic compounds out there in outer space. But why not? After all, carbon is the fourth most abundant element in the universe by mass. The more time and the more carbon atoms, the more likely you're going to find interesting organic molecules out there. But don't expect to see any green men from Ceres anytime too soon. That's it for that one. Let me drop. Researchers have engineered the design of a nuclear battery that gets its power from the beta decay of radioactive isotope nickel-63. The prototype, developed by a Russian researcher from three institutions, offers approximately 3,300 milliwatt-hours per gram. That's more than any other nickel-63-based nuclear battery and 10 times more of the energy offered by commercial chemical batteries. The scientists say that their battery produces enough power for use in artificial pacemakers. It's also notable that the half-life of nickel-63 is 100 years, making it feasible for use in many long-term applications. Let me drop. The researchers' prototype has layered appearance made up of 200 diamond converters interspersed with layers of stable nickel and radioactive nickel. The thickness of the layers directly affects the amount of power generated by the converters because the characteristics of each layer determine the number of absorbed beta particles. So that's it for that topic. Let me drop. Scientists from the University of New South Wales have created a new carbon-based material that is twice as absorbent as silica gel. Graphene is a remarkable material. It is made up of one layer of carbon atoms. The new desiccant is made from layers of this graphene oxide. that form high capillary pressure in the laminates and tunnel-like wrinkles in their surfaces. These properties have not been researched before, and they allow for a very high rate of absorption and desorption. It quickly picks up moisture, and it is quick to give it away into the atmosphere. These spaces between the layers can be fine-tuned to change moisture absorption rates specifically for each application. Now scientists will start conducting simulations to see how this desiccant works and what can be done with it. Let me drop. Discharging moisture is equally as important as absorbing it. Silica gel is a very good absorbent, though not as good as graphene oxide desiccant, but it requires a lot of heat to discharge its moisture. The new desiccant gives out its moisture in relatively low temperatures, making it to maintain. So another new material that's due to graphene. I should have a special graphene subject for every week. I'll go and look for that. Okay, that's it for that subject. Let me drop.
Roy, for a minute, please go back one. That nuclear nickel battery. Is that a laboratory curiosity? Do you remember if the article claimed that that's going to become a usable product in the next 5 years, so to speak? Any guess on that one, Roy? Go ahead.
It's a research product at this point. It's a proof of concept, if you will. It now is up to manufacturers to see if they can manufacture it at a reasonable cost per performance. Like many things, there's a lot of very interesting materials that material science comes up with. But when the engineers get to it and try and figure out how much it's going to cost to build the stuff, then it no longer pays to do it. So no one quite knows yet. You know, everything started in this phase. It's not a ready product. You're not going to see it tomorrow. You're not going to see it next year. You might see it in a couple years. You might see it in 10, 20 years. You might never see it. It's one of those things. But right now, it's a research proof of concept.
Thank you.
Okay, AC2GS again. The guys and gals at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory's National Ignition Facility have been very busy. They have achieved a total fusion neutron yield of 1.9 times 10 to the 16 and 54 kilojoules of fusion energy output, double the previous record. The details of the results will be published this week in Physical Review Letters. The National Ignition Facility is the world's largest and most energetic laser designed to perform experimental studies of fusion ignition and thermonuclear burn, the phenomena that powers the sun, stars, and modern nuclear weapons. The record-breaking experiment utilized a diamond capsule, a layer of ultra-thin, high-density carbon containing the deuterium-tritium fusion fuel seated inside a depleted uranium cavity. This approach allowed the researchers to greatly improve their control over the symmetry of the X-rays that drive the capsule, producing a rounder, more symmetric implosion. Let me drop. In addition to increased yield, the experiment produced other critical results. For the first time, the hotspot pressure topped out at approximately 360 gigabars. That's 360 billion atmospheres of pressure, exceeding the pressure at the center of the sun itself. Further, these record yields mean there was a record addition of energy to the hotspot due to the fusion of alpha particles by depositing their energy rather than escaping. The alpha particles further heat the fuel, increasing the rate of fusion reaction and thus producing more alpha particles. This leads to yield amplification, which in these experiments was almost by a factor of 3. As the implosions are further improved, this yield amplification could eventually lead to fusion ignition. So is commercial fusion power generation imminent? Well, it has been 30 years away for the last 60 years. So no, it isn't imminent. But maybe it's getting a little bit closer. Okay, that's it for that subject. Let me drop.
Yeah, the way you described the article, Roy, it gave us the energy output. Did it compare the ratio of energy input versus energy output? Are they at 80% of break-even, so to speak? Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, they're still not at unity. They're putting in more energy than they're taking out, but the article didn't give any specifics of the amount. Again, this is more of a research tool to see what they can possibly technologically do. And then if they find that it's useful, they can tweak the efficiencies and see if they can get up higher than before. At this point, I think they just want to see how big they can go boom. Okay, on to the next. One of my little pet theories is that the incredible rise of allergies might be due to very limited exposure to outside dirt and grime growing up. It helps to fine-tune our immune system. Having lived in a relatively clean room during most of our childhood, our sensitivity to molecules that aren't produced massively by ourselves rings our immune system's alarm bells and calls forth an inappropriate response ranging from runny noses, watery eyes, all the way up to fatal anaphylactic shock. In a similar vein, researchers at the University of San Diego School of Medicine with colleagues in Canada published their findings in the journal Allergy that the unique composition of mother's breast milk may help to reduce allergy sensitization in infants. They suggest that this might involve the role that human milk, oligosaccharides, found in mother's breast milk, but not in infant formula plays. Human milk, oligosaccharide, are structurally complicated sugar molecules unique to human breast milk. They are the third most abundant solid compound in human milk after lactose, which is a different type of sugar, and fat. They are not actually digestible by infants, but act as a prebiotic, helping to guide the development of the infant's gut microbiota, which previous research suggests is a key influencer of allergic disease. Past research has shown that breastfed infants have a lower risk for a variety of medical conditions such as wheezing, infections, asthma, and obesity. Recent research results have reinforced this belief, showing statistically significant lessening of the number of breastfed children who later develop allergic sensitivity to common allergens, including certain foods, like drops. Yeah, that was curious. Making it possible to determine who will get, not everyone exposed to influenza virus becomes ill, and while the exact reasons behind such variability have not yet been fully solved, scientists have identified a number of biomarkers predictive of who will experience the attendant's symptoms and have written about it in a recently published article in the journal Genome Medicine. The problem, however, is that predictions based on a variety of unknown biomarkers can only be made after infection has already taken place, but prior to the appearance of symptoms. Now, a group of researchers from Oxford University have discovered a new blood-based biomarker, a gene called ALRD1, which is expressed by antiviral cells, which could do a much better job. Let me drop. In the study, people with higher expressions of KLRD1 were found to be much less prone to catching the flu, most likely due to higher killer cell activity in their immune system. Then, once the subjects were infected, researchers found that volunteers who did not get sick had more natural killer cells prior to infection and also significantly higher expressions of KLRD1. Given the importance of killer cells in combating influenza, future endeavors could focus on developing vaccines or drugs capable of boosting that immune activity. Okay, that's it for this. Let me drop. Okay, I want to shift gears a little bit. We kind of did the headlines of the science news. So unless someone wants to kind of discuss the previous one, or you can wait until after I do this other little thing. I thought that Paul's discussion about NASA's Parker Solar Probe got me thinking about the sun, Sol, and what kinds of misconceptions we might share. So let me drop, and if anyone wants to talk about the previous stuff, I'll talk with them, or otherwise I'll move on to the sun for the time being.
WS2N.
Paul and Wesley in that order.
Just two of the previous topics. One, the first topic, dealing with this nuke that's riding around on this Russian vessel. I'm not sure what's the purpose of this nuke. Are they bringing it somewhere where they're going to hook it up and power a small town? What's the purpose of this this, it sounds like a barge because it's being pulled by tugboats. So it doesn't even sound like it's going under its own power. Maybe have a little bit more about that, Roy.
Yes, Paul. Basically, what these guys have decided to do, they need energy in some areas of Russia that they apparently want to build a reactor on site. So they decided to take two, they're called KLT-40 pressurized water reactors, and they're used for icebreakers, big, enormous icebreakers that the Russians use. And they put two of them basically on a barge and floated it across the Arctic Ocean. They're going to kind of moor it nearby, run wires out, and power a village in Russia. That's the plan, unless things don't turn out too well.
I know they're big time, you know, they want to control that. They're gearing up for people, population, power, the whole bit. Okay, that makes sense. The SMAP deal, the Soil Moisture Active Passive Satellite that went up, that was launched from California on a Delta 2 rocket. And I remember talking about that thing when that went up because it had an interesting antenna. That was the one with this, I think the antenna was about 21 feet in diameter. And it spins, you know, it was attached to the satellite and had this long arm sticking up, you know, going to the zenith and attached to the satellite, to the spinning reflector. And by doing this, they were able to, cover like 600 linear feet at a time as they flew across the Earth. But that thing apparently did not work, but it sounds like the passive part of the satellite was still working. That's why it was still getting all these good results. But I know that spinning contraption did not work. That was the problem early on. So that's the deal on SMAP. Back to you, Roy.
Very good, Paul. Thanks for the additional information. I'm trying to figure out how to access that information on Google Earth. The article said that it was available, but I haven't quite found it yet. It's probably hiding in plain sight. So that, you know, that'll be interesting to see. It's kind of amazing. In two or three days, they can pretty much tell you what the amount of moisture content in the soil over every landmass in the world. Science is amazing. Anyway, Wesley, you wanted to say something?
He's going to be in the area of biology and medicine. Can I?
Yeah, sure.
Cognitive enhancement, the TDCS, the transcranial and the brain current simulation. We're using electrodes and low current that is delivered to the brain. And this technique with these electrodes allows to increase neuroplasticity and make it easy for neurons to fire and form connection that enable learning. But the reason that I'm asking this question is because Oxford, a paper, was right now in critical stage standing about ethics in this area. So human-like animals could actually reach the level at which we will have that very much, let me drop, ethical problem in qualification or classification, as well as those brains who are enhanced versus the brains that are not yet enhanced, in terms of medical issues and in terms of learning, and placing human being in the hierarchy of the social structure. Back to you.
ethics is always a big question, and that's why we have philosophers, and we'll continue to have philosophers no matter what Stephen Hawking about philosophy being dead. There's the ethics of working on lesser animals. And there are some research studies. There was a gorilla who used sign language, who communicated, and, you know, you don't quite know what to make of that. I mean, does that mean that that gorillas are conscious and aware and sentient and should be given all the rights and privileges of mankind? I think most people at this point would say no, but who knows what the future will bring. I do not think poking electrodes and putting sparks into brains is going to improve cognitive ability dramatically enough to kind of trigger that. But we live in a weird time of genetic engineering, and there will be people who kind of reinvent the wheel and modify different forms of life to have bigger, more complex brain structures, and it will probably take us a lot longer to figure out what made us us. So, you know, it's not going to happen this week.